This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Ireland temporarily suspended AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine out of an abundance of caution Sunday, citing reports from the Norwegian Medicines Agency regarding a cluster of serious blood clotting in some recipients there. Three health workers in Norway who had recently received the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine were being treated in hospital for bleeding, blood clots, and a low count of blood platelets, according to the health authorities. Authorities in Denmark, Norway, and Iceland already suspended the use of the vaccine over clotting issues, while Austria stopped using a batch of AstraZeneca shots last week while investigating a death from coagulation disorders. Chile has become one of the top countries in the world at vaccinating its population against COVID-19, with more than 25% of its population having received at least one shot. The country of 19 million people and on South America's Pacific coast is a champion of Latin America right now. Globally, it is just behind Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. This is a far cry from the beginning of the pandemic, when Chile was targeted for criticism because of its inability to trace and isolate infected people. Martial law has been declared by the ruling junta and parts of the country's largest city as security forces killed more protesters in Myanmar in an increasing lethal crackdown on resistance to last month's military coup. At least 38 people were killed Sunday and dozens were injured in one of the deadliest days of the crackdown, according to the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, an independent group tracking the toll of violence. Most of those killed, 34, were in Yangon, where two townships were being placed under martial law. This is VOA News. Germany's Christian Democrats slumped to record defeats, and to record defeats, I should say, in two regional votes on Sunday after a muddled coronavirus response, dealing a setback to the party, which faces federal elections in September without Chancellor Angela Merkel. Merkel, in power since 2005, is not seeking re-election at the national vote, and her Christian Democratic Union is already missing the Merkel bonus she has brought them for the four consecutive national election victories. Anger over a face mask procurement scandal in the CDU is compounding frustration among Germans, with Merkel's conservative-led coalition over a sluggish coronavirus vaccine rollout caused by supply shortages and excessive bureaucracy. Voters use the state elections to vent their annoyance. Australians have been rallying in several cities demanding justice for women and calling out dangerous workplace cultures as the government reels from two rape allegations. Outside Parliament House, the crowd of hundreds was mostly female and most wore black. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, refused to address the crowd, and organizers said they would not meet him behind closed doors. Morrison stands by his attorney general, who was accused of raping a girl when he was 17. Separately, the defense minister has been criticized for failing to adequately support a staffer who alleged she was raped in Parliament House. Brittany Higgins told the crowd and that her colleagues treated her not as someone who suffered trauma, but as a political problem. Jury selection is entering its second week in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer who was charged in the death of George Floyd. Seven jurors have been chosen so far to hear evidence in Derek Chauvin's trial. Five men and two women. Four are white. One is mixed race. One is black. One is Hispanic. Attorneys will continue the process of questioning jurors one by one Monday. They need to pick 14 people. 12 will deliberate, and two will be alternates. Floyd was declared dead May 25th after Chauvin pressed his knee against his neck for about 9 minutes. Taylor Swift Folklore may have taken this year's Album of the Year at the Grammys, becoming the first woman to do so three times, but Beyoncé also made history by surpassing Alison Krauss to become the most decorated female in Grammy history after earning her 28th. Other notables include artist Her, winning Song of the Year for I Can't Breathe, Megan Thee Stallion for Best New Artist, Harry Styles' Watermelon Sugar for Best Pop Solo Performance, and Billie Eilish's Everything I Wanted for Record of the Year.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. I'm in for James Batty, and today is Monday, March the 15th. And here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Uganda's President Museveni is accusing the opposition of vote rigging and voter intimidation in the last elections.
I have reports here of very vicious intimidation by these NUP supporters.
And the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, is deploying a disaster assistance response team to Ethiopia's Tigray region.
We understand from our colleagues in the UN that they actually estimate 4.5 million people in Tigray are in need of assistance right now, urgent humanitarian assistance.
Sarah Charles from the USAID office here in Washington, D.C., and the government of Malawi says that it is registering a drastic drop in COVID-19 infections and death as the country prepares to start vaccination exercise this week. And the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports that an estimated 2.7 million Somalis will face severe food shortages. Those stories plus sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa, so stay tuned. The U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, is deploying a disaster assistance response team to Ethiopia's Tigray region. The team will respond to humanitarian needs stemming from months of conflict in the region. Fighting between federal government troops and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, a political party that was governing the province, has forced thousands of people to flee their homes, with millions in need of humanitarian aid. From USAID's Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance office here in Washington, Sarah Charles tells me that the response team will include disaster experts who will work with partners to provide assistance to communities affected by the conflict.
We understand from our colleagues in the UN that they actually estimate 4.5 million people in Tigray are in need of assistance right now, urgent humanitarian assistance. We've actually been operating in Tigray for some time now, even before the crisis, and ramped up in November in response to the crisis. But the access of us and our partners has been severely constrained, both by bureaucratic restrictions placed on the response by the government of Ethiopia, but also conflict dynamics due to the large number of armed actors that are operating in the region. We have seen some small movements by the government to improve access. They've made some statements in the last couple of days, actually moving from an approval system to a notification system from our partners. And we hope that by scaling up our assistance, by deploying what we call a disaster assistance response team, a DART team with experts in humanitarian programming, including protection experts, nutrition experts, food assistance experts, but also security experts who can work with our partners in navigating both the crisis dynamics in the region, but also working with them to navigate some of the bureaucratic constraints, that we will be able to scale up our assistance to the region. But of course, this all depends on the government of Ethiopia not just announcing improvements in access, but also following through and allowing for that increased access to the region so that we can mount the kind of humanitarian response that is needed given the dire, dire needs in the region.
And what type of humanitarian assistance are you providing? What are some of the more immediate needs right now in the region?
So already we're providing emergency nutrition assistance, water and sanitation support, and of course, food aid is a critical need right now, as well as some shelter assistance, given the significant displacement we've seen in the region. But what we really need is sustained access to the region to deliver, again, that food assistance at scale, to support health systems, as well as the kind of protection support for survivors of gender-based violence, again, given the needs that we already know of and many more that we assess, we understand, should we have comprehensive assessments, the kind of assistance that will will be needed for not just the immediate needs, but really needs over the next months and likely through the year and beyond.
Now, reports say that the situation in the region is particularly acute in rural areas. You know, people can't farm their crops, markets are closed. Will the response team be targeting these areas with some level of specificity?
That's right. And in fact, you know, I think I'm glad you highlighted those needs in rural areas, because most of the assistance to date that we have been able to provide has been in urban areas, when we know that there really is acute need in rural areas. More than 80% of the region is cut off from assistance right now, and that's what we're really trying to scale up. This crisis hit at the same time as harvest season. So not only do you have the needs that have been created by the crisis, but also by interrupted harvest. And so there really is a need to get in, get to the rural areas, scale up assistance to really stave off the worst. We are worried about really significant food insecurity and even the threat of famine should we not be able to scale up assistance in a timely way and in a sustained way.
That was Sarah Charles. I reached her at the USAID offices here in Washington, D.C. And Uganda's president is accusing the opposition of vote rigging in the just concluded elections. President Yoweri Museveni won the January elections. The results are disputed by the opposition. Mr. Museveni accuses his main challenger, the National Unity Platform, NUP, which is headed by Robert Chagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, for ballot stuffing and voter intimidation.
Because some of them would start ballot stuffing at 5 o'clock. There are so many stations where they would start ballot stuffing at 7 o'clock. Then intimidation I have reports here of very vicious intimidation by these NUP supporters in many areas, especially in Uganda, but also a little bit in the East, a little bit in Busoga. Very vicious intimidation, even attacks, burning of houses, burning of cars, cutting of banana plantations in some areas.
In a televised national address, Mr. Museveni also commented on the maize ban that the neighboring Kenya recently imposed on Uganda. He said that East Africa should rather focus on a federation.
When I had a chance to read Uganda, one of the other things I did was to work with Mzee Moi, Mzee Mwinyi, eventually Mzee Mkapa, to revive the East African common market. We have now a common market, and Uganda is benefiting a lot from that common market.
President Museveni also said that his government is working on a stimulus package for sectors that have been hard hit by the effects of COVID-19. And still in East Africa, in Kenya, the government says that it has not banned maize imports from neighboring Uganda and Tanzania. Peter Munya, Cabinet Secretary of Kenya's Ministry of Agriculture, says that Kenyan government is enforcing safety of imported food in the country. Traders in Uganda say that they are counting losses resulting from the temporary halt of trade between the two countries. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
John Walugembe, the head of Federation of Small and Medium Enterprises in Uganda, says farmers as well as maize merchants have been counting losses after the Kenyan Agriculture and Food Authority stopped maize imports from Uganda and Tanzania last week.
We have the farmers who grow this maize. It has meant that they have no market for their produce. The transporters, the financiers, the storage companies. So this ban has affected all kinds of businesses along the maize value chain, and it has created doubt among those actors as to whether there is a consistent market for our products, not just to Kenya, but also to other parts, to other countries.
Maize dealers said prices for maize had dropped from 400 Uganda shillings to 300 Uganda shillings after the ban, while other dealers said their products had started to rot in hundreds of trucks that were stuck at Busia town that borders with Kenya. The Agriculture and Food Authority in Kenya said last week that maize grain from Uganda contained cancer-causing aflatoxins. Aflatoxins are poisonous substances produced by certain kinds of fungi that contaminate food crops and pose a serious health threat to humans and livestock, according to World Health Organization, WHO. Walugembe says, as members of the East African community, Kenya ought to sit with Uganda authorities and seek for amicable solutions.
Our fear as SMEs is that issues of aflatoxins and other issues of that nature are simply used as excuses to put in place trade barriers that negate the gains that we've made through the EAC common market. So our recommendation really is the establishment of this bilateral trade disputes committee.
The East African Protocol, signed by members in 2009, grant free movement of goods and persons among member states. Peter Munya, Cabinet Secretary of Kenya's Ministry of Agriculture, says the Kenya government wants to ensure citizens consume quality goods.
6 months ago, there was that warning that the maize is not safe, and that information was communicated to them. So it's not like it's a sudden decision. It is just a compliant decision. So once it's compliant, the maize will continue flowing. We are only enforcing standards. So if somebody dries the maize, aflatoxin levels goes down, they'll be able to bring continue with the trade.
Kenyan government says it will now require a certificate of compliance from dealers intending to export maize to the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, reports that an estimated 2.7 million Somalis will face severe food shortages over the coming months as drought conditions affect more areas in the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Somalia's decade-long drought continues to chip away at people's ability to cope with the seemingly never-ending disaster. The worst has not yet come to pass. The UN reports pre-drought conditions already can be seen in parts of Somaliland, Puntland, Hirshabelle, Galmudug, and Jubaland states. OCHA spokesman Jens Layake says people in these areas who have barely recovered from last year's poor seasonal rains are facing a similarly grim situation this year.
Tens of thousands of people in Somalia have been forced to leave their homes since November because of extreme water shortages, and forecasts now indicate that the current rainy season, which runs from March to June, will only deliver below average rainfall.
Relief agencies report two consecutive seasons of scant rain results in crop failure, poor livestock production, and acute food insecurity. Layerke says the hunger crisis in Somalia will be at its worst between April and June. Among the estimated 2.7 million Somalis affected, he says, are 840,000 children under age five.
That is an increase of more than 65% compared to current levels. Water shortages will also increase the risk of disease outbreaks. The loss of rain-fed pasture is threatening the survival of livestock, which is the foundation of many Somalis' livelihoods. Displaced people have told OCHA that they are moving in search of water and pasture for their animals.
The United Nations has appealed for $1 billion to provide life-saving assistance this year to 4 million people in Somalia affected by conflict, climate change, and COVID-19. Layerke says only 2.5% of that funding has been received, a sum well below that needed to help Somalia cope with this emergency. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And let's go down to Southern Africa in Malawi, where the government says that it is registering a drastic drop in COVID-19 infections and death as the country prepares to start vaccinations this week. This past weekend, the Minister of Health announced that the number of people tested positive per day is now at 7%, compared to about 30% in January when the country declared COVID-19 a national disaster. Lamek Masina has more from Blantyre.
The drop is largely because of public adherence to COVID-19 preventive measures and restrictions introduced when President Lazarus Chakwera declared the pandemic a national disaster in January. The measures include night to dawn curfew, restricting gatherings to 50 people and closure of schools. Kumbize Kandodo Chiponda is Malawi's Minister of Health. She, however, says it is worrying that now many Malawians have stopped observing these preventive measures.
It is very disheartening that when you go around in town, you see many Malawians, they have stopped wearing masks, they have stopped social distancing, and indeed they have even stopped sanitizing and washing hands.
Figures from Public Health Institute of Malawi on the COVID-19 situation show that the country has for the past 3 months registered a drastic drop in coronavirus infections from about 600 total active cases on January 13. Malawi has of March 13 recorded as low as 43 active cases with over 190 recoveries and 3 deaths. Kandodo Chiponda says Malawi is looking to see number of people tested positive per day drop to 5% to consider easing some of the restrictions.
If that is the case, then we'll go back to our drawing board and review the guidelines, the regulations which have been there. We will do adjustments so that at least maybe our life can go back to a little bit normal, but also maybe some of the activities which we had stopped, you know, we can start doing them.
Dr. Jalamila Nkoma is the co-chairperson of Presidential Task Force on COVID-19. He says the current 7% drop on those tested positive per day means that the battle to fight the pandemic is still on. Malawi is expected to start COVID-19 vaccination program Monday after a launch Thursday when Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera got the first shot. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
And let's go to West Africa. In Nigeria, the country's central bank will reward Nigerians to use formal channels to get U.S. dollars from abroad. This move is meant to increase the flow of remittances as the country faces shortages of hard currency. The central bank says that recipients will get 5 naira for every $1 they remit through licensed international money transfer operators and commercial banks. The move comes as Nigeria's diaspora remittances, which many families rely on, dipped over the last year. According to data from the Central Bank of Nigeria, diaspora remittances to the country totaled $25 billion in 2019, but fell to just over $5 billion in 2020. From Lagos, Samuel Okocha has more on this.
At times, there might not be food at home. First of all, use some of it to stuff my kitchen with foodstuff.
Taufik, with a family of four, works in Lagos as a public servant. For several years, he receives money almost every month from his friend in the U.S. to take care of family expenses. But now, Taufik says, things have changed.
The money is no more coming. The only one I am working for, it cannot cover my expenses. So with that, it really affected me now, but then it didn't.
Taufik is one of many families that have experienced a drop in remittances. The drop comes on the back of the COVID-19 pandemic on the earnings of Nigerian migrants. But the fall in international remittances also coincides with the rise of cryptocurrency as recipients opt for non-traditional corridors when retrieving funds. Nigeria has now launched a promo to pay 1.2 cents for each dollar remitted to the country, a move that seemingly aims to combat the use of cryptocurrency, which the central bank has publicly kicked against.
The intention of government is to improve foreign reserve. That is the main reason behind the policy.
The central bank says its objective is to increase the inflows of diaspora remittances into the country. But analysts say the move is aimed at encouraging remittances through official corridors. Paul Alaje is an economist here in Nigeria.
As much as the policy means well, there are other concerns, which includes what is happening on parallel market today, which we have not been able to provide significant response to.
Unlike regulated financial institutions that use the official exchange rate, the growing popular crypto remittance companies reportedly use the parallel exchange rate when converting US dollars to Naira. As the gap between the official and parallel exchange rate increased, inflows via official channels declined, while the volumes handled by crypto companies surged. Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the sports with reactions from the continent following the election of Dr. Patrice Motsepe as the president of the Confederation of African Football. Sports administrators in his home country of South Africa say his emergence will take African football to the next level and make it more competitive.
Make sport accessible and make everyone happy. Congratulations, Dr. Motsepe.
I've served on the CAF Disciplinary Committee for a number of years. I think you're the best thing that could happen to South African football, but more importantly, the best thing that can happen to African football.
Kalusha Bwale is the former Zambia Football Association president.
Well, congratulations to South Africa as a continent, COSAFA, our region. Finally, you know, we have many football lovers, and I'm sure that everybody is happy.
Another reaction comes from Kunle Solaja, who is a veteran sports journalist based in Nigeria. He says Patrice Motsepe has a chance to breathe fresh air into sports administration on the continent's governing football body.
I believe that being the ninth richest man in Africa is going to bring the wealth of experience he had in creating wealth for his businesses to really bear on African football.
The new head of African football, Patrice Motsepe, was elected by acclamation during the 43rd CAF Congress, which took place in Rabat, Morocco, on Friday. In his first press conference, shortly after he was elected, the South African billionaire harped on unity and development of football on the continent.
There's a sense of urgency in terms of certain steps we have to take to ensure that African football is globally competitive and is also self-sustaining. And I said earlier on that the test of the success of African football has to do with what happens in every country.
In the meantime, former FIFA employee Veron Musengo Umba has been appointed the new General Secretary of the Confederation of African Football. The Swiss Congolese replaces Morocco's Abdel Bar, who had occupied a role in an acting capacity since March 2020. Musengo Umba has left his role as FIFA with immediate effect, according to the global body, where he had recently been working as Chief Member Associations Officer. And now to the CAF Champions League, where the match day 4 of the 2020-2021 Total CAF Champions League will be played across the continent on Tuesday, March 16th. In Group A, in Dar es Salaam, Simba FC of Tanzania will welcome Al Merrikh of Sudan. The other Group A game will see DR Congo welcoming Al Ahly of Egypt to Kinshasa. In Group B, it will be Al Hilal of Sudan versus Belouizdad of Algeria. Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa will be at home as a welcome TP Mazembe of DR Congo. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a great week ahead. And that's it for this Monday, March 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very great week ahead, Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.